Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dina Racer, who's a chief investigator of the Follow the Money Project and a partner at Bauman and Racer Group for over 25 years. She has for over 25 years of experience in investigating and exposing defense procurement fraud, and for 10 years directed the Washington, D.C.-based Project on Military Procurement, a nonprofit organization that worked with whistleblowers and sources inside the Pentagon and defense industry, exposing fraud and waste. She's authored The Pentagon Underground and co-authored Betraying Our Troops, The Destructive Results of Privatizing War. And she has an article, Truth Out, Slow-Rolling Massacre Unfolds in the Shadow of Shocking High-profile shooting sprees. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dina Racer.
Hi, nice to be on again.
And normally, Dina, we talk about your work in exposing fraud and waste in the Pentagon and in the military procurement system. And of course, we started out today with P.S. Bray, the designer of the A-10 and F-16, and talking about Chuck Hagel, who he thinks is a disaster. But an even greater disaster would be Michel Flournoy, who is also being touted, and Ashton Carter. So before we get into the fact that you've written this article, it's somewhat a departure from what you normally cover, which I really want to talk to you about. Any comments on the Hagel nomination?
Well, you know, at least Hagel has shown signs that he can be shamed into doing the right thing. He was not so hardcore that he didn't do a giant mea culpa in the gay issue, and the other thing, the guy's been to war. I mean, he knows it. You know, I think the neocons just hate him because they haven't, and he has, and he knows that. And he, over the years, has become more and more concerned about the Pentagon, the waste, the committing of troops, the contractors, the ridiculous wars. And so, as my mentor, who worked in the Pentagon for 45 years, Ernie Fitzgerald, he would call him the best of a bad lot.
Okay. Well, let's then move to the reason I'm calling you, Adina, about this very moving article that you've written at Truth Out, Slow-Rolling Massacre Unfolds in the Shadow of Shocking High-Profile Shooting Sprees. And it's a personal perspective about a nation's shock and grief over a horrific act in a place where such things aren't supposed to happen. That's in Newtown, Connecticut, and the places where similar tragedies occur almost every day, where children grow up in a relentless tide of violence. Now, clearly what got you upset and it was the media response to what happened in Newtown, where and I saw this myself, it was appalling, where so many people in the media said, you know, this is the town is in grief. This is just not supposed to happen here, which leads you to ask the question, well, where is it supposed to happen?
That's right. And by the way, I should tell you that I mainly am working now as a columnist for Truth Out. I have a column called Solutions Making Government Work and do a lot of Pentagon. But this just struck me. I just had to do something because I was very proud of the fact that I live in El Cerrito, California, which is just, it's what I call a hybrid town. It's in between Berkeley and the University of California and Richmond, California, which is a very, very, one of the most dangerous towns in, there's really only, you know, it's almost like the Middle East. There's really only 5-10 miles in between all this. And El Cerrito is a small town like Newtown. You know, we have a marching band and a debate team and a homecoming parade. But it's very multicultural. It's what I call a hybrid town. We have all economic stratas, all races. It's my high school that my kids went to was a majority-minority high school. So my kids went through. I got to know kids from all different sizes. Some of my kids' best friends lived in a really scary part of Richmond. And I felt like, wow, I really understand living in a diverse society. But my youngest son decided when he was in middle school and beginning high school to play for a California youth football team in Richmond, California. And anyone who wants to go to the article at Truth Out can look at the picture. And the picture says 1,000 words. He was the only white kid. And usually, that wasn't as unusual in that situation because usually there's Asians and there's Hispanics and there's, you know, and there's blacks and African-American kids, you know, the whole thing. Filipino, whatever. And when I took him for tryouts, he was 100% black. It was just 100% African-American kids. And the coaches, I got to know the coaches. And we were treated so well. I mean, I have to tell you, we were the only white couple sitting in the stands. And my son wore black Under Armour under all his football clothing. So, and he was the center. So the only way time you could ever see that he was white is that he put out his Day-Glo white hand because he was the center, like the ball. So we got to see something that what I normally in my middle to upper middle class existence, I grew up in a complete lily white towns, Lexington, Massachusetts, and Kettering, Ohio, and basically knew no minorities when I moved to California. But what really shook me was the killings that just were going on during this my short little dip into this, and it included one of the kids who had made it up to University of Oregon and was going to get a full football scholarship was shot dead 2 days before he'd left. And there were these kids on these teams. We had lots of strict discipline. They had to be tutored. But when the coaches had to let them go after football season, they couldn't keep hold of them all the time. And some of the kids actually shot each other from different neighborhoods. So finally, it was just the end of it is out of the three coaches, there was two brothers who were the assistant coaches, and they had really come basically out of the bad part, had done drugs and gone to jail and came back and made something of themselves and didn't want the kids, and the head coach. And one of the brothers got shot, partially for going back and trying to pull the kids out of the neighborhoods to get them into the Richmond Steelers. And so when they had the award ceremonies that year, for the kids to graduate into high school football teams, the 14-year-olds, they all line up, and of course there's my Day-Glo white kid son. But they had the mayor and the ministers and everybody there, and they went to each one of these kids and they prayed over them that they would make it to adulthood. And they prayed over my son, and I felt so guilty because I knew statistically my son had a very good chance of making it to adulthood, and a lot of these kids were at risk. And it just, I kind of went on with life. My kids now just graduated from college and football and all that. And when I was sitting there watching that television, it just hit me like a knife. I mean, I literally screamed to the television, where is it supposed to happen? And then I realized this was a terrible tragedy that just knifed us all, and you know, in the heart and everything else. But just 5 miles from me was this slow-rolling massacre still going on year after year after year. And I thought we'd see it on the news and see it on a blip, and every time I'd see, you know, that some young man of 21 would be killed, I'd wince and think, gosh, was that one of those kids I knew on the team? And I went back to Coach Kalia, and he was the only surviving coach. The main coach also had died of cancer, and they were
working hard to keep these kids out of trouble. That was their
it just broke their hearts. You could just see that when his brother was killed, and then Coach Fred had cancer, which he was really kind of young. He's only 62, and he had, you know, the main coach. He had control of it, but the cancer just ate him up in 2 years. And so I had lost track of Khalid, and Khalid quit being a coach, and he has a foundation which really is not set up right, and he doesn't know what to do. But he makes enough money, and from 2005 to now, he has pulled 10 kids out of that quagmire and got them bachelor's degrees, while getting his associate degree now, and he's going to go get his own bachelor's degree. And we talked about how we both grew up, and how this all worked, when he went to an El Cerrito school, it's all the same school district, when he was 6 years old, he had never talked to anybody white. He was like me, only at an earlier age. He had never had any exposure to anybody out of that neighborhood of his. And he was amazed that these kids all knew by sixth grade where they wanted to go to college and what they wanted to do. But he got put back into the school, the bad high school in Richmond. And he just knew he couldn't go to college. He wasn't the kind of guy that went to college. And it just struck me, and I finally, you know, at the end of the article said, I'm not going to sit around and do this anymore. I'm going to find Khalid, and I'm going to do something about it. I'm going to try. I might not be able to do a lot about it. It's huge problems. It's got a lot to do with, it's almost less with race now and more of economic disadvantage. And I said, I'm going to go in there, and I'm going to go out of my comfort zone, go back into Richmond, and see if I can help Khalid pull kids out. And now I'm going to have lunch with him on Sunday and write another column next Thursday about what, both with my son, talking about what can we do about this.
And this, of course,
I had a little dip into it, and I could go back to El Cerrito, but I think about the people who live there with their kids year after year getting killed.
And this is happening 5 miles from your home in the town of Richmond, which is really where the Chevron refinery is. It seems to be dominating that. One of the most dangerous cities in California, and gun violence is so rampant that it's taken the lives of more than 900 of its citizens since 1990. And you're talking about what just happened in Newtown, Connecticut, where people in the media kept saying this is not supposed to happen here, which raised the question of where is it supposed to happen? And then the answer to this question is that it happens all the time in poorer neighborhoods across this country. Every day, young schoolboys and schoolgirls, too, to a lesser extent, yes, are shot down.
And it's painful to me because I'm now looking to write the next column. And the whole teddy bear and lighting a candle with teddy bears and laying them out in the street and stuff, just people driving hundreds of miles to do that, is just drives me crazy because it really is. It's really not helping the parents, because the parents are just completely devastated. One of my best, dearest friend's son is a clergyman there, and he's going through his own living hell, trying to help these families. But it's a way that makes them feel better. It's a kind of Martha Stewart way to make them feel better. And they have they have a fund for the families. And I understand that this is a terrible situation, and this is a terrible thing to happen to these families. And they've raised $3.5 million. But I have to think about, you know, that these families lived in this town because they were, middle to upper middle class. And I don't really know what that money is going to do for that community that they don't already have. They already have grief counselors. They already got people volunteering. But what would $3.5 million do to someone like Coach Khalid to help pull kids out, get them in get them educations, bachelor's degrees, where they have a chance? Get them to understand, have leadership classes where they interact with other kids that are from other socioeconomics, and make them understand, yes, you can go to college. You can do this. You can get out of here. You can then make it better. You can make yourself, better kind of thing.
Well, Dina, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I thank you. I thank you for your article at Truth Out. Slow rolling massacre unfolds in the shadow of shocking high profile shooting sprees. Again, chief investigator of the Follow the Money Project, Dina Racer. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I would like to thank producer Jose Benavides and Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And the conversation continues at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.